Well, well, this is episode 11 or 12 of The Bad Apples, and today Gort is on furlough. In his place is the one and only Skirlet Hutzenreiter. And Skirlet is a graphic designer and web designer under the employ of The international company Osteopod.
Web design.
Photoshop magician extraordinaire, which incidentally ties in largely to what we'll be talking about today. And today we're going to be talking about the GNU Image Manipulation Program.
The GIMP,
yes. And I'm going to do a complete walkthrough, sort of an intro to the GIMP and to graphic design in general. But first of all, I want to kind of talk to you, Skirlet, a little bit about the GIMP and maybe what your exposure to it has been, what your feelings on it might be as someone who's working in the industry, pretty much married to Photoshop.
Well, I don't have any experience on it, actually, but I've been wanting to get on there, and I have it on my computer, but I'm excited to test drive it to be sure.
Cool, yeah. I can't wait for you to see it, because, as you know, I use it all the time, even though, I mean, I'm totally Photoshop certified. I know you are.
Yeah.
We both aren't exactly, we're not light users of Photoshop by any means, but I do use GIMP as much as I can because I love the program. It's a really, really cool feat of programming. Of course, it's a big thing about it is that it's open source.
So it's free.
Completely free to use.
Definitely the most intriguing thing about it for me.
Yeah, well, I think it is.
That's why I have it on my machine.
Yeah, I think it is intriguing for a lot of people. Photoshop is a lot of money. Adobe knows that they can charge a lot of money for it because they have industries that are literally dependent upon their program, Photoshop. So while that might be totally manageable for these big industry magazines and things like that, it's not
necessary for an everyday person or even a small company.
Right. Well, exactly. And I'm sure even though Osteopod is a big international company, they could probably benefit from not having to pay the creative pack, I think, is like $1,300 for Photoshop, Dreamweaver, Flash,
right,
and all that other
yeah.
good stuff. It's a big expense that you could theoretically cut out if you're not necessarily using everything.
Well, especially if you're not using all the features, which most people don't.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. I know that there's web graphics and then there's print graphics, and I know web uses RGB and print uses CMYK. I mean, most people I know just stay in RGB or grayscale. They never...
Yeah, most people aren't going to go to those industrial presses.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff I do, it doesn't require anywhere near as many colors for that it's going on the web.
Right,
never even goes to print.
Yeah, yeah. And digital printers don't require CMYK anyway. But yeah, and actually I have a clip. I have an audio clip from the Linux World podcast from a guy that they're interviewing who's sort of an open source entrepreneur. He's an investor in a lot of open source projects, sits on a lot of boards and stuff like that. And he has an interesting thing to say about
it. Let's hear it.
Yeah, I'll play it.
Hello, and welcome to the Linux World Podcast. I'm sitting here with Larry Augustin, who is the board member of OSDL, board member of Zensource, and Tahoe. Any others you want to...
Sugar CRM.
Chairman of VA Software.
There's a lot of commercial software out there that's bloated with a huge amount of features that people don't need, that they end up paying for. Not just paying for in cost, paying for in, resources on the machine, paying for in that it's less secure because it's just bigger, or that it's buggier because it's bigger, right?
Right.
And what they really need is software that does the set of what they want, not everything in the world.
That is the classic problem with all pro apps. There are always going to be thousands of users that don't use many of those features, but they're going to pay for them.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm sure it's probably pretty hard to justify for a lot of people and, again, small businesses buying such elaborate programs when you're just not using all those features. But they're kind of the industry standard at the same time, so you feel like, well, maybe...
Well, still, I mean, a lot of people aren't necessarily in the industry.
Yeah.
Great selling point for the GIMP.
Oh, I think so, yeah. It's great. I mean, it's a strength of open source. The other side of that Scarlett, is that I can't tell you how many times people come to me. They know I know Photoshop. They know I know Max. They come to me. They throw their computer down in front of me, point at it, and tell me it's not doing what it's supposed to do. And I can't tell you how many times I'll open up one of their applications that they're saying is not working properly. The splash screen comes up and it's some completely different name than theirs. Maybe it's even like a hacker's name, you know. All bets are off at that point. I see that it's a cracked version. There's no way of telling why it might be malfunctioning. If you've got legal copies that you've bought, then at least you have some assurance that everything has been installed correctly. You can always reinstall and everything is in working order. But if it's something that you've gotten off of BitTorrent or something, or LimeWire or something like that, there's no telling what you have gotten and what you have not gotten. There's really no assurance that you're even starting from a working copy, much less can you start to determine, should something go wrong, why that's gone wrong. So yeah, it's a great thing to have a copy that you know is a real copy, is a good copy, and working copy.
And you designed a lot of the like graphics and wallpaper for your website
All the wallpaper that I do for the Bad Apples is with the GIMP. All the source art that I post are the GIMP files rather than like PSDs or something like that. And in fact, that's a good point. All the wallpaper for this week, the source files are the lesson files for this episode.
Oh, cool! So people can follow along.
Yeah. So if you want to follow along at home, you can download the source files from the typical place, which is thebadapples.5gbfree.com.
Where can they get the GIMP?
Good question. Where can they get the GIMP? Well, if they've been with this podcast for, I guess in episode 5, we did an installation of the Fink project, which is a project that helps Mac users have access to a lot of the open source Unix-based programs, which the GIMP is. And so they might have installed it back then. Now, the other way, if they haven't done all that, at least you have to have X11 installed on the computer.
Good old X11.
Yeah. Do you use X11 much?
I know that's what I need to run open source.
Okay. Very good. And that is correct. That's the Unix. That's basically the raw Unix side of your Mac. X being the window environment for your Unix stuff. So if you have X11, you can run the GIMP within that, but you'll still have to go get the GIMP at gimp.org/Macintosh, I think is the easiest way to get it. You
Great.
Can download the file, install it, and then just run it within X11. So it's not going to look all pretty and Macintosh-y and Aqua and stuff like that. It's going to look maybe a little bit scary at first, a little bit PC-ish, a little bit window-ish, but that's just that's a side effect of being, you know, in raw Unix and you know, it's not using the same window decoration that Mac is.
Who cares what it looks like? Let's just get into it.
I think that's a great idea, Scarlett. You're my kind of web designer. Let's do it. Okay, so I'm assuming that you have the GNU image manipulation program installed on your system, that it's up and running, and that you've downloaded all the source files. The default layout when you first open the GIMP are just two windows. There's one titled the GIMP, and that's your tool palette. That's where all the tools that you're going to be using to design your stuff live. The other one is just it's a workspace palette. It has a lot of different capabilities. I think the default has 3 or 4 tabs on it, but it's going to be something that you're going to go to a lot. The important one is the layer palette. You'll be using that a lot as we talk, and then we'll add some different palettes and some different tabs as we go. Now, what you'll need after that is a canvas. And once you get your canvas up, which is where you're actually going to be working, you're going to be drawing and designing into, that will have a whole host of new menus that we'll explore together. The first file that we'll open is the skateboard.png. To open that, you'll just go to the file menu there on the main toolbar, and you'll click on Open, or you can just hit Control-O I believe it is, for the shortcut. Remember, you're in X11, so some of the keyboard shortcuts that we would normally use, like Apple O for open, don't apply, simply because this is written for a generic Unix rather than specifically for the Mac. And when you open, you can find the skateboard.png and bring that into the GIMP. You'll probably be greeted when you first boot up the GIMP by a tip of the day. Those are always good to read. They're just kind of quick tips on little features that are good to be aware of. All right, now when you open the image, the first thing that you see, or that you might notice if you're used to Photoshop, is the little marquee, the little dotted line around the entirety of the image. Now, on Photoshop, you don't see that, but in the GIMP, they define layers as independent entities aside from the canvas, which will kind of become evident as the more we work in this. You'll kind of get the feel for what a layer is in the GIMP versus Photoshop. But right now, this canvas size is the size of the picture, and the image size is also the size of the picture. So let's go into the image menu, which should be located right there in your main picture window, the actual canvas itself. Go to Image, and go to Scale Image. And this is where, in Photoshop, it would be called the image size, and this is where you would scale the image to be whatever resolution that you want it to be and whatever pixels wide and high you would want the image to be. So at this point, we're going to make the image size from a very high DPI down to a low DPI. 72 is the kind of standard for web, and is this anything you're going to just view on the monitor, it tends to be approximately 72 dots per inch. So we'll down this to 72 DPI, but at the same time we will up the pixel count to about 1405 wide to approximately, well, whatever it says for it. Mine, I think it's 1675 pixels high. Luckily, since there's that link by the image size, you type in one number and it does the calculation to figure out the next one. So go ahead and do that, and that will make your image quite large. You'll probably be seeing only a small portion of your image because typically it doesn't zoom out away from the image. Right now you're seeing every pixel for every pixel. It's not scaling it down for you. But at the bottom of the canvas, there is a drop-down menu that says right now 100%. You can down that to approximately 33%, and you'll see the image as a whole. Now, it's important to know that you shouldn't really edit images when you're scaled out, when you're zoomed out from it. So you want to zoom out, or you want to zoom in, rather, when you're going to edit for detail, so that you're actually getting all the pixels that you want when you're making selections or painting something, things like that. And you'll see what I mean as we continue. Well, right now this dimension isn't proper for a monitor. I mean, this wouldn't serve as a wallpaper because it's just too high and not wide enough, which is okay. What we'll want to do is make our canvas larger, and this is where the difference between a layer and a canvas is going to become pretty obvious. So if you go to the image menu again and go to canvas size, here is where you can define what kind of space you have around this layer. So I'm making mine 2560 wide and 1600 high, which is the exact dimensions of the 30-inch screen that Apple sells. So that way anyone from someone with a 20-inch monitor or a 13-inch MacBook all the way up to a 30-inch monitor could use this as their wallpaper. Now, understand that if you make it this large, you're going to really need a lot of RAM. I recently upgraded my RAM, so I've got plenty of space in my random access memory to play around with, but otherwise this might slow you down. So you might want to do something a little bit smaller if you don't have the same system that I have. But the dimensions that I'm using right now are 2560 by 1600. A great way to figure out maybe what you should do for your own system is just go to your System Preferences, which is located in the Apple menu. Go into the Displays Preference pane and look at what sizes your monitor is available at. Right now you're probably at anywhere from 1024 by 768 up to 1440 by 900 up to maybe 1600 by 1200. Find that information out, and if you want to design larger, you can do that. It'll always be able to scale down to fit your monitor. But if you design small and then try to scale up after the fact, that doesn't work so well. So you always want to overshoot at least one monitor size. At least that's what I try to do. Except in this case where I'm trying to overshoot to pretty much every possible monitor that Apple sells. So I've got a 2560 by 1600. I tell it to resize, and now I've got a lot of blank space around the image. Now here is another difference between GIMP and Photoshop. In Photoshop, and in GIMP, you have something called a background layer. And that would be kind of the bottom of the canvas. It's the actual physical surface you would be designing graphics on. If you were drawing, it would be the paper you were drawing on. Now, in digital graphic design, the advantage is that it's all digital and we can have transparent layers. So if we've got a photograph, it would be akin to laying down a sheet of acetate or a sheet of glass over it, upon which we could then paint. And even though you'd see the paint that you're doing on the glass, you'd still see the background. That layer of glass would be called an alpha channel. It's an invisible layer that you can place over things so that you can see straight down through them if you need to. In Photoshop, to make a background layer, which is your default starting place, to make that a floating layer, something with an alpha channel in it, with invisibility, you simply double-click on the background layer, you name it whatever layer you want to call it, and you suddenly have a layer that's floating around. And if you slide another layer under it, if you punch a hole through your current layer, you'll see right down through it to that layer underneath it that you've added. In GIMP, it's similar, but it's just done a different way. You go to the layer menu in your canvas. You go down to the transparency menu, and there's a selection there called Add Alpha Channel. You add an alpha channel, which is the invisible layer that I'm talking about, and that makes everything outside of your current layer transparent. So while we started with this picture of a skateboard, and then we added negative space around it, in order to be able to see through that negative space, we have to make that negative space an alpha layer, an alpha channel. And that's what that does. And so now, if we put something underneath all of this, we'll see right through it. And that's what we want, because obviously we don't want the skateboard and the cement just kind of hanging out there with a cool-looking background behind it. We want to have the cool-looking background behind just the skateboard. Which brings us to our next task. We have to lose this horrible-looking brown cement stuff behind the skateboard. That's a technique that you're going to encounter all the time in graphic design. It's kind of like that's what graphic design is. You need to cut shapes out. You need to take images of a person in front of one structure and cut them out and put them somewhere else. It's just kind of like one of the most basic things in graphic design. It's one of the big things that Photoshop was famous for really early on, because you could always take things and you could mask it out and drop some other background behind your image. So while it is something that is done frequently, it's not necessarily always the easiest thing to do. So I'm going to guide you through some of the most common ways to do it. The first way we're going to do won't work, but I want you to get an idea for what your first step would typically be. Obviously, no one wants to do more work than they have to in any job, even if it's graphic design where you're having a lot of fun. So the first thing that you would go to is to in Photoshop it's called the magic wand. In the GIMP, it's just called the contiguous region selection tool. The keyboard shortcut for that, rather inexplicably, is Z, the Z key. I don't know, I haven't been able to come up with a good way to remember that yet, so that's just what it is. What this is going to do is select every pixel of a certain shade. Now that doesn't mean every pixel of just brown. It means everything from a dark brown all the way to a light brown. So ideally, if you click in the brown area, you would get a lot of selected areas in that. And then if you hold down the shift key and select another shade of brown, it'll start multiplying and it'll start selecting a lot of things within that image. Now the problem here is that there's just not enough contrast between that brown cement and that pink skateboard. They're very much, in terms of color, they're very near the same kind of end of the spectrum, so this tool isn't really doing us a whole lot of good. I mean, the first click does great. If you click on like some of that dark brown area at first, it looks fantastic. It looks like we're really on our way. But the minute you start trying to get some of that lighter shade of brown in there with it, you start getting a lot of the skateboard, and that's a problem. But that is typically your first stop. That tool is going to be something that you're going to use quite a lot. The other great way to select things in Photoshop is with the magnetic lasso, which you'll see a lasso tool here in GIMP. They call it the hand-drawn region. It's the keyboard shortcut, just the letter F. And if you select that, you pretty much have free rein over what you're selecting. You just click and drag, and you're drawing a shape around the object. Now, as you can tell, you'd have to have the steadiest of hands to be able to, and the most precise mouse, to be able to actually select just the area that you want. I mean, I'm doing it right now as I speak, and I've got everything selected, and it looks terrible. So what I like to do in GIMP is I like to draw a path around the object that I want to select. And what a path is something that is used a lot of times in illustration programs, but GIMP has really great path tools. And I use paths a lot more in GIMP than I do in Photoshop because I really like the way that the path tools in the GIMP function. They function really well. I think it's a big strength of GIMP. And it really, where Photoshop fails, I think, is to integrate Illustrator with Photoshop. I mean, they started to try to do that after Photoshop 7, like once they started the whole CS thing, they really were trying to introduce paths and things like that into Photoshop. But I think that they're really lagging in that area. But GIMP, it's very, very transparent. It's very easy to use the path tools to convert selections into paths and vice versa. And that's what we're going to do here. We're going to draw a path around the skateboard, then we're going to convert it into a selection. So what you want to do first is zoom in a lot closer to the skateboard than you are right now. So you need to be at 100%. The way to maneuver around your image in GIMP, one of the easiest ways for me is there in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a little cross. And if you click on that, it pops up a little navigator, a little image, and it shows you where you are in relation to the whole image. And you can kind of grab that little box and navigate around your image until you see in your window what you need to see. So once you have the top of the skateboard showing in your window, you can start drawing your paths. Now the tool that you're going to use for this is the Create and Edit Path tool, which I call the Pen tool. And for whatever reason, they've assigned the letter B, as in boy. That's the keyboard shortcut for that. That's another one. I'm not really too sure of a good way to remember that. I've been trying to come up with one, but can't. Ballpoint pen, maybe? I don't know. If you click at the top of the skateboard, that creates a little node, a little circle. And then if you give yourself a couple of pixels down the left edge of the skateboard, you can draw another one. And don't worry about it if you're cutting it off a little bit, because we're going to come back through and we're going to do what paths do best, which is bend and change and morph for us to fit around the object that we're trying to create. So I wouldn't worry too much about being too precise at first. What I like to do is kind of break down the object into a series of paths. So where it kind of bulges out there at the top of the skateboard, I make that one straight line. And now where it's dipping in right there on the vision sticker in the middle, I'm going to make that another straight line. And I'll just pull that path in later on. And I'll take it all the way down to the beginning of the tail of the skateboard. That'll be one line. I'll make a little tiny path for the very corner. I feel daring, so I'm just going to make one big line right across the back of the skateboard, and I'm just going to see if we can actually make that tuck in ourselves. Now, around the wheel, I'm going to be a little bit more precise, just because I don't really want to have to deal with it too much later on. But you can do whatever you feel is necessary. But it's just a matter of clicking to make a node, moving out a little ways, and then clicking again to create the line between them. Now understand that we're not actually drawing anything on this image. What we're doing is we're creating a path for GIMP to follow. It's almost like we're doing a little bit of programming. We're just telling it, okay, we want you to focus in on this area, and at some point I'm going to have some kind of job for you to do with this area. And so now that you're finished all those paths, you can go in and you can just, with the same tool, you can grab those paths and start modifying them so that they fit right around the edges of that skateboard. And so where I drew completely straight lines, I now have complete flexibility, and I can make my path bend, and depending on where I grab it and drag it, I can actually determine like the angle of the curve. And these are Bezier curves, so when you hear people talking about Bezier tool and Bezier curves, that's all this is. You're taking a path and you're modifying the angle of the curve. And as you do more of this, you'll get more used to it. So the goal is to be fairly precise in what you're doing. I mean, this is going to be the thing that we use to cut this skateboard out away from the rest of the image. Now, because this is not super high resolution stuff, I mean, we're just going out to a monitor. Some imprecision is probably okay, and we can fix a lot of it after we cut the board out. We'll be able to go in with like an eraser tool or something and get rid of any excess brown pixels. But you want to try to get pretty close to the pink skateboard as possible. But if you're clipping it off a little bit, clip off pink rather than giving yourself brown, because we do want just if we have a hard edge, it'll look better than having brown floating outside of the skateboard. So once you've finished all of that, you can go to the Select menu up there in the canvas, and you're going to choose the From Path selection. So that knows that we want to take a path and turn it into a selection. So I click on it, and suddenly you get the selection. A lot of people call it the marching ants. It's the little dotted line that's moving around the skateboard. And so that's what we have selected. And now if you hit Control X for cut, you'll see that you've cut that skateboard right out of the background, and you can actually just discard that background layer. We're not going to come back to that cement at all at this point. Now what you'll have to do is paste the skateboard back onto your image. And I like to do this right away, because typically what you'll do if you keep something in your clipboard and you kind of forget about it, you're going to end up copying something on accident and completely demolishing what you had in your clipboard. Not a good idea. So what we'll do is we'll add a new layer, and we can call it, I like to name my layers as much as I can just because that keeps me organized. The layer fill type will be transparency, because again, we don't actually want this to be anchored anywhere. We want it to be a free-floating layer that we can throw things underneath, things like that, without really minding, without having to punch a hole into it to see through it. So we want the invisibility. And now you just hit Control V for paste. And that pastes your layer in. And once again, notice how you've got a selection around not only the skateboard, but as a box around the entire area that the skateboard occupies. And that's because in GIMP, as opposed to Photoshop, the layers are just the object that you've got on that layer. In Photoshop, the layer is always as large as, or at least perceptively, it's always as large as the canvas size. In GIMP, one of the things to remember is that your layer is just what you've got selected. That's the layer, and if it's transparent, it's just not there. In Photoshop, there's a sense that if it's transparent, there's a layer there. It's just nothing's in that layer. But in the GIMP, the layer is just the objects that you've put onto that layer. It's a little bit different. Takes you a little bit of time to get used to it, but it's a difference. Once you've pasted the selection, you have a floating selection. So that is something that's just kind of floating there. It's not assigned to any layer yet. So now that you've got it, you need to anchor it. And at the bottom of your layers palette there on the left, there's a little anchor right next to the trash can. And that's the anchor floating layer. So you want to click on that, and that assigns it to whatever empty layer is underneath it. So now it's been actually pasted into the skateboard layer. And now, as long as we have our canvas selected, hit M for move, and you'll get your move tool, and you can click the skateboard and kind of move it over to the right, or wherever you want to place it on your version. I'm going to move mine to the right. And now we have a free-floating skateboard, pretty well cut out on my version, and just nothing behind it. So let's go ahead and throw something behind it. For that, we'll need to make a new layer, and this is where the transparency is going to become really obvious to you. So I'm going to call this cement, the new blank layer. I'm going to have it just fill in with transparency, because again, I don't really want anything in it. I want to put a pattern into it myself. If you hit Shift B for bucket, that's the paint bucket, this will enable us to fill something, fill a layer in with some kind of color or pattern. Okay, so this deserves a little bit of attention. So right now we've got two layers. We've got a skateboard layer, and underneath that we have a blank empty layer called cement. If you click onto cement, that makes that layer the active layer. So anything we do right now will affect that layer. Now, in our layer palette, we have, by default, I believe you have three or four tabs. There should be a layer tab, a channels tab, a paths tab, and a undo history tab. That's just by default. Now, you can bring in more palettes into one window. And the one that I love to add, and I have always turned on by default, is my tool options tab. And this, for Photoshop users, would be that big long strip across the top in Photoshop, where you can actually define, even though you have a tool, a lot of times a tool will have three or four different things that it can do, three or four different functions, and you can define the properties and the ways that this tool will react. So to add the tab to this palette, there's a little box next to the layers label and right above the mode where it says normal. There's a little, it looks like a little, well, it's a triangle in a rectangle. It looks like a play button, like on a DVD player or something. And this is where you can add different tabs. Second selection in that menu is add tab. And the one that we want to add is the tool options. Now, there are a lot of different tabs that you can add, and feel free to add as many tabs as you want because they're really handy. None of these are, I mean, all of these are something that you're going to be using a lot, especially like the fonts and the colors, possibly the histogram. It just kind of depends on what kind of work you do, but definitely the tool options. So if I click on the tool options now, the default is to fill with the foreground color. Your other options is the BG color fill, which would be background color fill, and your pattern fill. And what we want to do is a pattern fill here. And then right under that is a list of all the patterns that GIMP comes with by default. And you can scroll down, and there are many ways to, you know, you can make your own patterns, things like that. But we'll just use their default. It's called the slate pattern. So just keep scrolling down until you find it. It's like a gray, kind of rough, cement-like pattern. Now that you've got that selected, click over on your canvas, click in, and it should fill that bottom layer with your slate pattern. So it looks kind of like a pretty computer-generated cement pattern. But that's not what we're going to leave there anyway. But it's good for now, and it's what we're going to build off of. Now we've got a free-floating skateboard right over the cement. And it almost looks kind of cool right now. You'll probably notice, however, that we'll probably want to have some kind of shadow under that skateboard, because obviously in real life you're never looking at anything. This looks very two-dimensional. In real life there's always some kind of separation. So to give it that 3D separation, we actually can use one of the filter scripts that come with GIMP in the menu there in the canvas window called Script Foo. And under Script Foo you'll see shadow, and you'll see drop shadow. Click on that and it'll bring up pop-up menu asking you how to define your shadow. This is always done in pixels, so if you don't have a really good conception of pixels, you'll want to kind of play around and try to get used to pixels, because when you're designing for web or for wallpapers or anything that's going to be viewed on a screen, it's helpful to have an idea of what a pixel is and how that relates to certain... I mean, when you have an image that is 2,560 pixels across, a drop shadow of 8 really isn't that much, because it's only 8 little pixels across almost 3,000 pixels. On the other hand, if you're working on an image that's 1024 by 768 across, now you're talking about 8 being pretty substantial size. So you need to kind of get an idea of what pixels are and how many pixels you need depending on whatever your canvas size is. So in this case, since I'm working on the 2560 by 1600 image, I'm going to up my offset of the drop shadow to a good, I don't know, 16 pixels with a blur radius, so I'll just keep it at the default of 15. The color I'll leave as black, the opacity I'll leave at 80. So that'll be a very natural looking shadow, I think. I'll say okay, and Script Foo throws a shadow underneath the skateboard. And it does it really well, and it adds another layer named drop shadow. And that's really a nice feature of this, because unlike Photoshop, you can't really necessarily, without rasterizing the effect, you can't actually modify that effect. But on GIMP, you can. It just adds it as a layer. You can turn it on and off, just like in Photoshop. But you can just go in with your eraser tool, which is Shift-E, keyboard shortcut. Go in with your eraser tool, and maybe if you don't want the shadow so strong under the wheels, which would, in theory, be touching the cement, no? You can go in and kind of touch that up and erase it a little bit. And that, to me, seems a little bit more realistic. Now, the eraser and the paintbrush and a couple of different tools all are defined by the global brush palette. Now, I have the brush palette turned on under my layer palette, so I always see the brushes, the brush menu right under my tools. You will also will see a number of different options within your tool option palette. Once you have selected the eraser, it'll give you the softness, the size, things like that. So you've got a lot of different options, and you can play around with them. Depending on what you're going for, depends on what you're going to be, what kind of brush you're going to want to use. Now, since this is real life and we have a fairly hard shadow, I'm not going to use a super soft eraser. But a lot of times a very soft eraser is very helpful if you don't want there to be hard edges across something that you're changing. The pressure sensitivity, all those things, playing around with those a lot of times will give you lots of interesting effects that maybe you didn't even realize were possible at first. So I'm going to use a slightly large brush. And again, the size of my brush is going to be relative to the size of the picture, because if I'm using a 3000 pixel canvas and I want to erase a large area, I'm going to need a huge brush, like maybe a 485 by 485 diameter brush. Whereas if I'm working on a very small canvas, 1024 by 768, you know, a 400 diameter brush would take up, what, one quarter of the screen? Okay, so now what we're going to do is add some decoration behind the skateboard on top of that cement layer. And in order to do that, we'll have to make another layer. So click on your cement layer and hit the little blank piece of paper on the left, the bottom left there. And that creates a new layer, which you can call stripe. And now we've got a blank layer. And we're going to use our ink tool, which is keyboard shortcut is the K for ink. The K. So you hit K, you get your ink tool, and go to your tool options palette. And let's make the size maybe 10 pixels if you're working at my resolution. If you're working by 1068 by 768, you'd probably be looking at maybe 5 pixels, something like that. We're going to want the shape to be a square rather than either the circle or the diamond. And everything else is pretty much, I think, good. We'll want to also make the color that we're in white. So now over in the toolbar, you'll see the color swatches. Those are the squares with the color, the two colors in them. Right now they're probably just black and white. That's call your color swatch. The top one is your foreground color. The back one is your background color. And for this, we'll want the foreground, that is the ink that we're actually using, to be white. The quick way to do this is just hit the X key, and that's something that similar. That's you do that in Photoshop, you do that in GIMP. Hit X, and it will switch your foreground and your background colors. So hit X, and it brings your white to the front, black back to the background. So now that we've got white ink in our pen, we can click. Well, one thing that I like to do when I'm doing this, when I'm going from one end of the canvas to another end, is to draw my window out a little bit. So I like to move my window up and grab that bottom corner and give myself some of that dead area around my canvas. And that way we can draw right off the page and then right across it, and we don't worry about not getting like one pixel towards the edge. We're overshooting a little bit. So I'm going to click just outside of one side of the canvas, go out over to the other side, hit Shift key, and you'll see that GIMP knows that you've made one click on one end, and if you hit the Shift key, it draws an imaginary line to where you are now. And now you can adjust your line so that it's completely straight, and then click again, and it fills it in with white. It's a very handy trick. And you can do just move down a little bit and do the same thing. Click, hold down Shift, move to where you want to be, make sure your line is more or less straight, click again, and now you've got two nice lines making a very nice little stripe across your canvas. Now, on the original image, I had some graffiti or something in between those stripes. The way you do that is the text tool, which is a keyboard shortcut of T for text. You can also find it in your tool palette. And you simply kind of click where you want it to go, and it opens up a dialog box asking you to enter the text that you want it to enter. I put in CHPWN, which is some slang for some stuff. You can put in whatever you want to, maybe your name or some phrase that represents how cool you are, whatever. And then I put in an apple, which is, of course, Option Shift K, gives you the apple sign. And then you can close that dialog box, and you'll see that you've now got that text in your canvas. Now, right now, it's really small, probably a little bit too small. That's pretty easy to fix. If you've got your tool options palette open, like I do, then you can go over to it. It's turned into a T now. It's a contextual palette. It's always going to be whatever tool you're currently in. And since we're on the text layer that we've just created, it knows what we're looking at. And you can increase the size to whatever size you want. You can also go to your font menu and make it whatever font you want. These are all free fonts, so they are going to have different names than maybe what you're used to. But if you just kind of look through them and get a sense for what you've got to choose from, you'll kind of get the idea. I'm going to use the Malige Not Rotated, or Malige Not Rotated. That's kind of a generic Geneva / Helvetica looking kind of font. It's good enough for me. But feel free to look through, you know, whatever you've got. Feel free also to just make your own fonts, either with Font Forge, which I mentioned in some other episode sometime, I don't remember which one. Or you can also just do it with vector shapes here, you know, draw your paths and then fill in your path, and just it becomes sort of a handwritten, you know, one-time font. With your Move tool, you can move that text layer around to be exactly where you want it to be. And now you've got a nice little stripe with some text in there going across your canvas. Now, in the original image, we have it going, I think, diagonal across the canvas, and that's easily done. So if we click on the text layer in our layers palette, you'll see the ability to actually link two layers together. So if I click on the text and click right next to that eyeball, a chain appears. And then if I still on the text layer, I can click where that chain would be on the stripe layer. And now I've linked them two the two layers together, because they both have little links next to them. They know that if I move one, the other one is going to move along with it. And then I can go up to my layer menu in my canvas. I can go to Transform, Arbitrary Rotation. And now I can grab those layers and rotate them along with each other. Now, it might look like just one of those layers is moving, but don't worry, since they're linked, they're both going to be affected. So you can select whichever one you actually want to judge your rotation by. Grab your Move tool after you've done the rotation. To commit the change, by the way, of the actual rotation, just hit Enter. That'll commit the rotation. And then you can move it around on your canvas with your Move tool. Again, the keyboard shortcut for that is M. And in fact, now that I'm at it, I think I'm going to go ahead and link the skateboard and its drop shadow to each other. So click on the skateboard layer in your layer palette, click the chain link on, and then click the chain link of the drop shadow. And I'm going to rotate that as well. And again, to rotate, you go to your layer palette in your canvas, go to the transform menu, go down to arbitrary rotation. I typically ignore the pop-up window. I mean, you can do it by angle as well, just as easily, just use the slider. But I'm kind of used to, between using Flash and Photoshop and everything else, to just kind of do it by hand. And to do it by hand, you just position your arrow over the nodes that appear around the layer, and you can kind of drag them around and get a feel for what it's going to look like. Remember not to rotate it in such a way that the shadow becomes unnatural. We've created a shadow at such an offset that it's, you know, the light source looks like it's coming from one direction. You don't want to rotate it so that it looks totally unnatural. Okay, so I've rotated mine. Looks great. Looks fantastic. Make sure that you haven't accidentally linked your skateboard along with your other layers. It's something that you have to watch out for. You know, you don't want to have everything linked to each other on accident. Oh, now look at you. You're all tuckered out from all this graphic design. Well, luckily for you, that music, as always, means that it's time for a coffee break. I'm going to go get myself a great cup of coffee. Why don't you? We'll meet back here for more GIMP action momentarily. So we're getting pretty close to the final product here. What we can do is give it a little bit of color. The gray look just isn't doing it for me. If it's doing it for you, that's great. But the pink skateboard and the gray cement just doesn't quite work for me. So now what we're going to do is just under the skateboard and its drop shadow, you're going to make a new layer. Again, that's that little blank sheet of paper on the lower left of your layer palette. You can make it transparent. Now we've got an empty layer awaiting some kind of color. So you can grab your paint bucket tool, which again is Shift B, also in your tool palette. And also in your tool palette, you got your color swatches. So this is where we're going to actually go into our color swatch and pick a color. And to do that, it's quite easy. You just click on the foreground color, which is right now white. And that brings up your color selector. You've got both your color wheel and just your shade selection that looks very much like the one in Photoshop. And you can just pick, I like a light blue to offset the pink. Don't make it too dark because we're going to end up combining this with that cement layer under it. So make it kind of a light blue. And to do that, you just drag your mouse, click and drag over the colors until you find a nice shade that you like. And then you hit OK. And you should see that color come up in your color swatch. So that's your current color. Make sure that you've got your paint bucket. Now we need to go to our tool option to make sure that we're not going to fill in a pattern again, because we'd selected earlier to fill pattern. Now we want to do the foreground color fill. So you just select that once, go back to your canvas, click once, give it a moment, and it fills that layer in with the blue. And now we'll go up in our layer palette, go up to the mode. And this is compositing. This is what Photoshop is famous for. This is what all these programs do really well, which is take different layers that you've created and do interesting things with them, like overlay or multiply. And what they're doing on a technical level is they're taking, for instance, the darkest pixels in one layer and either multiplying it by the lighter pixels in another layer, or they're adding it to those. You know, it's taking pixels from different layers and doing different things with them. And the more you play around with compositing modes, the sooner you start to get a feel for what they're doing. And then all kinds of different effects can be created depending on what different combination you're telling the program to do. Usually when you're playing around with modes, a lot of times there's not a whole lot that you can do wrong. Especially if you're new to compositing, pretty much anything you do is going to look really cool. On this one, I think I'm going to do an overlay, but you can do whatever you want, whatever you think looks coolest. And now we're really, really close to the final product. As you can see, you've got your cool-looking background, you've got your skateboard that's been cut out and applied a drop shadow to, and understand that these principles are things that are common to all the graphic programs. This is the kind of work that people are doing both on film with digital mats and in magazines where you see people who just appear way too perfect to be real. Probably they aren't real. They're photoshopped. That's the big gag. The one thing we might want to do is fix that sticker across the skateboard. The grip tape has the Vision logo on it. It's got some guy's name on it. Technically speaking, obviously, I can't release that as a wallpaper without getting permission from Vision. For your own use, if you like that, you can obviously use it. But maybe we want to be sure that we can actually distribute this. So we'll want to zoom in at 100%. We'll want to go over there to that sticker. And we're going to want to grab that area and bring it onto its own layer. Not necessarily because we need it on its own layer, it's just because I like to isolate things that I'm working on so that I can then really kind of be messy when I'm working on it and not spill over around into it. And you'll see what I mean. So go onto your skateboard layer, maybe get your path tool again, and start drawing a path around just that blue grip tape area. You can be pretty rough with this. I'm doing it in four steps pretty quickly. Once you've done that, go to your select menu in your canvas. And again, you're going to choose from path so that we're making a selection from the path. And now I've got just that blue grip tape area. So now in my edit menu in the canvas, I'm going to go to copy. So now I've copied that. Now I'm going to make a new layer in my layer palette. I'll call it blue. So all I've done is make an empty layer for my clipboard. And now I'm going to go back to my edit selection, and I'm going to say paste into. And that pastes the exact same thing over itself, which is a weird thing to do because it doesn't look like you've really pasted it at all, but you have. And you can confirm that in your layer palette because it's a floating selection. So again, just hit anchor to anchor it into that new empty layer that you've created for it. And you can click outside if you hit R for your rectangular selection area and click outside of it to deselect it. Now you've just got this blue area. And here's the trick. In the layer palette, next to the mode drop-down menu, there's a little checkbox next to the little checkerboard. This is the keep transparency selection. And if we have that selected on, whatever we do outside of that layer just won't carry over. So we've really kind of we've put masking tape around this layer so that we can be really sloppy within this area and it won't matter at all. And you'll see what I mean if you go to your tool palette and you find your paint using patterns or image regions tool, which is C, probably for clone. Now what this tool does is it takes an area of the image and duplicates it into another area. And again, it's going to go off of your brush size, so you want to make sure that you're using a brush size that makes sense for your image. And you're going to want to make sure that your source in your tool options palette is your image source, not your pattern source. Get that tool, go back to your canvas, make sure that you've got a good brush size. Obviously, you don't want to be using something that's going to be too big, but not too small either. So if you're in your canvas, you click Control, your cursor becomes a little target. And you can click on maybe some of that dark blue up in the right corner as your origin. And now if you take your brush over to the Vision logo and start painting over it, see what it's doing is basically it's painting relative to where you originally clicked when you defined your origin. It's really a tricky tool, but once you get good at it, it makes a whole lot of sense. And sometimes you might have to go back and redefine your origin so that you don't keep painting the same thing over and over again. This doesn't have to be super clean because we're going to probably put another color over it anyway. We just want to make sure that the Vision logo doesn't show through when we do put another color onto it. And that's going to be something that's going to take some time. You'll just have to keep clicking, control click on a clean area of the image, and then click normally over the Vision logo. And whatever you clicked on in the first place with control key held down will be pasted or painted over what you're clicking next. It's like you're just borrowing hues of one or portions of one part of the image and kind of smudging them over the other part of the image. It's a very handy tool. You're going to use it a lot if you're ever doing retouching, trying to get rid of like a pimple or a scar or something like that. You can always just take a sample of the skin just outside of the scar and then paint that skin right over the scar. It's how people are made to look so good in most magazines. It's all the clone tool. So it's a really good one to get used to. So play around with that for a while. And while you're at it, if you try to paint outside of the blue area, like I was saying, it just won't do it. That's because we've blocked off the transparency. We've said anything that's invisible, don't let us paint out into that area. And that's a really handy tool for things like this, where you're just trying to get some quick stuff done. You don't want to go messing up your skateboard. You don't want to get paint outside of that. So you're blocking off everything that was originally invisible, and you're making it off limits to your tool. Very handy device. Okay, so the same thing is going to go with this layer. So if we go to the layer palette, we select the blue layer that we're working in. If you control click on that, you can duplicate that layer. So now what we have is yet another layer, the same size, same everything, right over our blue layer. Right now it's called blue copy, might as well just keep it named that. But what we're going to do is going to fill that in with maybe another shade of blue. To do that, the easiest way, rather than going getting our paint bucket like we did for the layers underneath the skateboard. We're just going to go to our edit menu in our canvas, and we're going to go down to the bottom, and we're going to fill with foreground color, which should still be that same shade of blue. And that fills it in with a solid blue. Now that doesn't look quite natural, so again you're going to go to your composite menu, and you're going to play around until you find a good shade, a good effect for that blue. So that you've got the dark cloned grip tape under it, and you're just overlaying it with a new shade of blue or whatever color you prefer, whatever color it ends up being after you've composited it. And that's just a good way to kind of get a new look in there without it looking like you've cloned it too much and without looking too drab. It kind of brings a new dimension to it. Now on top of that layer, we're going to put the Apple logo. And the easiest way to get an Apple logo, if you're using a Mac, is you get your text tool, click somewhere, hit Option Apple K, and that gives you an Apple layer. And you close that layer, and you can hit M for move, so that you position that Apple right on the grip tape. And you can leave it at any angle that you want, although, like I say, if you want to transform it, just go to your layer menu, go down to transform, and do an arbitrary rotation on it. Now, obviously, this is a solid Apple logo, and on the finished product we had the multicolored classic logo. I'm going to leave that up to you. If you've been following along, I think you probably get the idea of how to make things different colors, paint over it, take that Apple logo, keep the transparency around it, grab an ink tool or something, and just start coloring it in. There's a lot of different ways to do it, though. I'm going to leave it up to you. Now, to get this to composite well over that grip tape, we're going to need yet another copy of that Apple. So again, control-clicking on your Apple layer, duplicating the layer. Now we've got two Apples right on top of each other. The bottom one, we want to make that white. The top one, you can make it whatever color you want. And for the white Apple, just take the... Right underneath the composite mode, there's that slider for opacity. And you'll want to bring the opacity down a couple of notches so that when you composite the Apple on top of that, it's not completely compositing on top of the blue grip tape. It has to pass through a vaguely white layer first, and that kind of strengthens that Apple, the colors, whatever colors you end up using. To combine things onto another layer, a lot of times it is very helpful to just throw a multiply on there, and sometimes that's too drastic depending on what color pixels you're dealing with on both layers. And to lessen the effect, you can stick a white layer under, you know, between those two, so that, yeah, you're multiplying, but you're not necessarily multiplying 100% of each pixel. But that way, by multiplying, you get the same texture from the grip tape, for instance, on the Apple. So it's a good trick to know, something to play around with, kind of perfect on your own. And the top one, I'm going to overlay over that one. And you can, it might not be the same for you, simply because depending on what colors you're using, they're going to interact differently with the layer underneath them. But you can play around with it. But the idea is to get it to look fairly natural, so that it looks like it's actually printed on the grip tape rather than something that you've placed over the image yourself as a graphic designer. But once you've done all that, you've pretty much got the finished product sitting in front of you. And if you zoom out 33-ish%, you'll see the whole thing. And it should look pretty cool, depending on what you've done. And there's a lot of tools in the GIMP that you can use to add personal touches to it. One of the coolest tools in the GIMP is the pin tool, which we used to draw our stripes in the first place. We used it in one of the straight edge, most, you know, linear fashions ever. Really didn't do it justice, so I wanted to mention it really quick. Part of the coolest thing about this ink pen is that it's very much it acts like pen, like ink. Portions of it will be smooth and portions of it will be fatter and thinner, things like that. And you can really get some cool effects with this if you change the pixel size of your tool to kind of give it a splattered ink look, and then go back over that with some thicker stuff to kind of give it the thicker ink over the stray lines. It starts to look really neat, and you can do some really cool ink effects. So I encourage you to just play around with the different tools. But the main ideas, I think, you've gotten from this walkthrough. You've got your your different palettes, your layer palette, your tool options palette. You've got your menus, your main menus in the canvas window. You've got your whole tool set that you can play around with. Distort things, fill things in, give gradients to things. You've got your composite modes, which will live there in your layers palette all the time. You can always composite something over something else. Usually it gives you some cool effect, depending on what color you're compositing, obviously, but a lot of times if you want to do something neat, hey, try a different compositing layer. Who knows, it might look totally cool. So that's pretty much all I've got for you, I think. That's, a really good intro to both the GIMP and to graphic design. I hope you found it helpful. I hope you are able to play around with GIMP and do some really cool stuff. Obviously, if you do anything and want to share with the rest of the world, send it to gort.klaatu@gmail.com, and we will post it on the site. That's it. Have a great time using free open source software, Unix-based, on your Macintosh. This has been episode, 11 or 12 or something, of The Bad Apples. If you would like to send us an email, you can. It's gort.klaatu, that's gort.klaatu, klaatu, @gmail.com. You can send us any ideas or questions or even GIMP art. We welcome all kinds of communication. If you would like to pick up your free desktop art for this episode and other episodes, please do stop by thebadapples.5gbfree.com. That is thebadapples.5gbfree.com. This will also lead you to all archived episodes. And all the content in this episode is licensed, for this episode we'll license it under the BSD license. So whatever that is, that's what this is licensed under. Don't abuse it. Come back next week for more Mac hacks, Mac apps, and weird Unix tricks on The Bad Apples.
Everybody should have something to be interested in.